Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and yeah, some different music this week at the intro because, it's my happy music. I'm in my new office. I now have a dedicated space to work in for the first time in my entire career. I'll post some photos when the finishing touches are done, but I am in there now. I've got a lovely view of the bush behind my house instead of a sheet of plasterboard, and I've also got some decent reference monitors now, and they've helped me realize that my EQ, my mix, has been too bass heavy for about a decade, so you'll probably notice this week's show actually sounds a little bit different. Now, this week's show is a little bit trimmed down. As you can imagine, I've had a pretty busy week moving everything in. But I did post a Snake Oilers edition last week, three vendors talking about their stuff in a way that won't make you want to stab yourself in the face. So do check that one out if you haven't already. I'll run part two of that edition while I'm on leave week after next. I'll be off work for a couple of weeks with the family, going to a sunny place, nice beaches, that sort of thing. But I'll have part two of that Snake Oilers and also a soapbox to post while I'm away. So on this week's show, we're going to go long on news, and then we'll be checking in with this week's sponsor, Marco Slaviero from Thinkst Canary, and we'll be talking about how some vendors are getting a little bit too fancy for their own good when it comes to so-called deception technology. But of course, before all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, confusion reigns this week. David Sanger, the journalist, has written a book about all things cyber and made some claims about FireEye or Mandiant's investigation into the APT1 report that dropped back in 2013. Made some claims about that report that have since been refuted, and it's all been very confusing.
Yeah, this has been quite a schmozzle, I guess. In his book, which is entitled The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age, has a bunch of stuff. And one of the bits that's caught, I guess, the ire of readers so far was his description of FireEye hacking into the Chinese APT1, office building, breaking into their webcams and then, hacking them back to do attribution. And as the story goes, as David Sanger tells it, he was watching some of the things as they unfurled as part of some of the work he was doing back then, part of the reporting, and claims to have seen them going through this process of hacking back. And the particular claim was that he had seen out the webcams of the attackers in their office building, in China, which...
But the alarm bell started ringing for most people when he said that he could see their keystrokes from their webcam. And it's like, that's a strange angled webcam.
Yes, the story rather started to unravel as people went, what now? Anyway, it seems that it kind of, I'm not quite sure exactly how it got, it got confused. There's been a flurry of statements, from Mandiant and FireEye and, some personal posts from people like Richard Baitlich kind of talking about the fact that they didn't do that exact kind of thing, that they weren't in the hacking back business. And rather, as they reported at the time, they had owned a bunch of the jump hosts in the middle and were recording the desktop sessions.
Well, actually, they say that they didn't own those jump points. So the official narrative back then coming out of Mandiant was that they, and this is the unmasking of, Unit 61398. For those who aren't familiar, go Google the APT1 report, because it's a while ago now. It was like 5 years ago. So the idea was they reckon that they got close enough to some of the Chinese hot points so that they could actually grab their RDP sessions, man in the middle of them, and get their screens that way. And that's how they were able to get things like images of the people, because they were using their hot points for personal traffic because it bypassed the Great Firewall of China. Now, which is plausible, right? Now, at the time, and I still believe that Mandiant probably did have a poke around a couple of C2s. And when this first round broke now with David Sanger saying, they owned the individual operators' workstations, I said, wow, I didn't think they got as far as the workstations, but, I certainly thought they owned the C2 at the time. And, they would have had to have got the nod to do this. And the word at the time very much was that Mandiant either was instructed or sought permission to drop that report at the time, because it was a really big deal. This was the first real public doxing of a Chinese SIGINT campaign, and it was used very heavily by government to do stuff. But yeah, maybe them actually owning the individual operators' systems was a little bit too good to be true. Because I'm thinking, if I'm Mandiant, I'm not going to do that in front of a journalist, right?
It does seem like it would be a poorly thought out thing to do. And certainly if you take Baitlich's blog post at its face value, it's very clear that that's not a thing that they wanted to do or in fact did. So yeah, it's, you know, whether or not that report was, you know, sanctioned, and the narrative certainly makes sense that that would be sanctioned to provide a public
source. Would you drop a report like that without checking with the US government first?
Well, exactly right. You don't want to be in a position where you're being scolded by the US government for not doing your part, as we see with one of the other vendors later on in the news list.
And did
week.
You hear, did you hear any single complaint from the US government about the APT1 report?
Exactly right. Yeah. That was a very useful tool for them to have in the public eye from, you know, public sources without any involvement of, you know, sources and methods with uppercase S&M.
And yeah, I did really hear at the time that they got the nod to drop the report. I sort of implied in a tweet the other day that, you know, the nod meant more. I don't think they would have got the nod to actually start popping shells. But what do you think? Do you reckon they would have actually had a poke around a C2? Because I can't see them not doing that. Like, that just seems ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a pretty juicy thing to be sitting on a, you know, sitting on a shell on a C2. Well, I mean, sitting in the middle of a live RDP session, maybe the guy goes to take a bathroom break, leaves it logged in, you have a bit of a poke around. Yeah, I mean, that would be a hard thing to resist doing. And certainly, I mean, the value to your investigation would be huge by being able to have a poke around and have a quick look. You know, run a netstat or something and have a bit of a squiz, you know, would be a handy thing to do. You know, and certainly if you're close enough to be able to, you know, man in the middle of the RDP stream in the first place, then, you know, you're probably close enough to then reuse those credentials and log in yourself. Or, yeah, it would be pretty tempting, I would have thought.
Yes, it would be pretty tempting. But I think the TLDR from this is that take everything in that book with a grain of salt.
Well, yeah, unfortunately. And we certainly reported on a bunch of other David Sanger work, you know, over the last couple of years on the show. And, yeah, some of them, you know, I guess it makes you go back and think, well, how much of that did we take at face value, and maybe we should be a little bit more cautious there. I don't know.
Yeah. Switching to some other news. Reality Winner. I still can't get used to her name. I just
such
can't.
A great name.
Reality Winner. Reality Winner has accepted a guilty plea for leaking that report on, you know, Russian attacks against US election. Was it election officers or whatever it was? And yeah, she's looking at about 63 months, was it, in prison?
Yeah, I think the she's facing 63 months, but final sentencing is not yet done. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see, you know, what they've agreed on. She's been, 13 months so far in prison. So, I guess you know, there's going to be a bit more of that to run. We're also seeing the usual sorts of discussions about whether or not the Espionage Act was kind of the appropriate tool to kind of wave in her direction, because she didn't really have many opportunities to defend herself using a public interest defense, because that's the kind of the specific criticism of the Espionage Act. So yeah, there's the usual kind of back and forward about that, you know, from the ACLU and those type of people. But, you know, it's kind of hard not to have some sympathy for that.
Well, I mean, look, she could be out in about 4 years, which I would think is kind of a, you know, I mean, hey, personally, I think that's a bit harsh, but you can sort of, you can't really argue too strenuously that that's an unreasonable sentence for leaking, you know, highly classified documents from NSA.
It's certainly a lot less than it could be. I mean, you know, we
it's
see
a lot less than Snowden
of,
will get. Let's put it that way.
Well, yeah, exactly. And even, I mean, some of the other, you know, computer crime things that have been, you know, people are facing, you know, 10 to 20 years in jail for, you know, DOSing something. So yeah, it doesn't seem as out of whack as we might expect sometimes with the US judicial system.
Now, speaking of the US judicial system, the Supreme Court in the United States has just ruled that police now need a warrant for mobile location data, which is, you know, it's an interesting development because, you know, a lot of this stuff is obtained, a lot of metadata is obtained without warrant. And it looks like in this case, they're saying, no, location information is just that little bit more sensitive, that it deserves to get a similar treatment to, you know, content interception as opposed to just metadata, which feels to me to be like a pretty good decision, right?
Yeah, it feels like a move in the right direction. I mean, this case has been the one that's been challenging sort of the concept of the third-party doctrine where you share information with service providers, you don't necessarily have an expectation of privacy in the same way that you do with your own data, but the court's kind of recognizing that location information is, as you say, just like that one step further down the track than the sorts of other metadata that kind of, you know, 40-year-old doctrine kind of, you know, was considering. So yeah, this seems like a step in the right direction. Of course, people are trying to relate this particular case with the more recent stories about the phone companies in the US selling location data to aggregators.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, this Supreme Court decision does absolutely nothing to address that, right? And it's funny because I had a similar conversation, a conversation about this stuff with last week's feature guest, Alex Tilley, who used to work for Australia's Federal Police. And I was asking him about this, this is before the court decision, about how that would apply here. Like, can you actually just go and buy, if the information is available for sale, could you just go and buy it? If you were a Fed? And he's like, well, I think so. you know, because you're not using police powers. And that's, it looks like this is the case and the interpretation here in the United States, which is if someone's going to sell you the location of your target for $5, then you probably don't need a warrant because it's just, you know, publicly, pseudo-publicly available information. And Krebs notes that in his report, that this isn't going to do much.
Yeah, I mean, that seems pretty sensible. It would be silly for them to get a warrant where you can just go, you know, if you're a marketing agency, you can go and buy it, or a bail bondsman is the next kind of
one
of the stories that's broken this week in the US.
Selling locations for $7.50, right? I mean, that's the thing. Why would you need a warrant when you can just buy it without having exercise, you know, government or police powers?
Yeah. So, no, I think, you know, obviously this conversation about location information, you know, is going to continue going on. And this, you know, it's good context, this particular Supreme Court decision, but it's certainly not directly relevant. And we're going to have to see some more conversations, I think, you know, between the consumers who are having their, you know, locations sold and everybody else.
Mm. Now, speaking of Alex, he was on the show last week, of course, talking about how email scammers are targeting property buyers, you know, all over the world. And it is certainly hitting us here in Australia. Here in Australia, we're moving towards more electronic settlements, right? Which you would think would take care of a lot of this, type of fraud, instead of relying on conveyances and their crappy old, you know, exchange web access servers or whatever.
Fax machines, no doubt.
Yeah, exactly right. So, well, fax machines would probably be better. But anyway, that's a whole other topic. But this company PEXA, which is owned by the big four banks and state governments here in Australia, and this system and systems like it are becoming mandatory. Someone managed to own a conveyancer who was using that system, add themselves as a user, and managed to, you know, manipulate account information and rack off with $250,000 belonging to like the most telegenic, like hardworking family I think I've ever seen in Australia, and the whole thing's just blown up. It's just blown up big time.
Yeah, no, it really has. It's been getting coverage all over the place in the mainstream press, which, you know, is kind of good, and it does look like that. You know, flurry of media coverage because of the very photogenic victims has kind of, you know, forced this particular, you know, organization behind the platform to, you know, make some changes relatively rapidly, the security of the platform. I think in this case, it was a pretty straightforward hack. I mean, the someone's email got owned, they did a password reset, added themselves as a user, changed the bank account details, and then just kind of authorized the rest of the process. And then when it got to the actual paperwork phase, no one noticed, and off the money went. I think they did, in fact, get the money back.
No, they did not. They got Commonwealth Bank was able to recover about $138,000 of the $250,000. And this is the thing. We spoke about this liability black hole. I think their only hope now is the conveyances insurance might cover it. But the company itself, PEXA, I mean, this is clearly a process deficiency when someone's able to just pop in a mailbox and add themselves as a user. Like, you know, where is your 2FA? Where is your verification? Why aren't you requiring identity verification for each one of these, you know, conveyances accounts? Like, it is clearly a process deficiency on PEXA's side. As for the couple themselves, they were offered a loan from PEXA, and one of the conditions was they kept their mouths shut. And they would also have a caveat on their house, and they have told them to jam it, and they're all over A Current Affair and stuff. This and it's mostly been the woman in the family. She's a former MasterChef contestant or something, very comfortable in front of a camera, and she's great. You know, I watched the you know, the sort of tabloid TV segment that was done on this, and she has been absolutely on point with all of this. But the crazy thing is, this is sort of turning into a discussion in the mainstream media about the dangers of electronic settlement, which seems to be missing the point.
Yeah, I agree, right? I mean, it's clearly, you know, clearly we're moving towards electronic everything, and it is possible to build these things in a way that they are robust against, let's face it, a pretty obvious class of attack here. And, you know, it makes me wonder, like, you know, who did the security threat modeling for it? Who did the testing for it? Who accepted all the risks that testing identified without actually bothering to fix them? Because, I mean, this is exactly what you would expect, right? If you asked us, you know, I put on my pen tester hat for a moment, if you asked us to test this would exactly be the sort of thing that we would test. And it just kind of suggests that, you know, we haven't as an industry, you know, that builds software and electronic solutions for things, really accepted the reality of the world that we live in yet, which is that if you have a high value transaction system, this is going to happen.
Yeah, and that's ultimately it's easier to fix when you're using a centralized system like PEXA, as opposed to just, as I said before, just all conveyances doing this with email documents and whatever. There's much more opportunity for fraud there. But, you know, that it's only an improvement if they're actually doing it right, which clearly they weren't. And I hope that they won't wind up having to actually fork out for this because they've treated this family terribly, like, and I want them to suffer. That would be great. Now, last week I also mentioned that, you know, it might be a nice idea if Microsoft were to force 2FA onto 0365 users. It looks like they've made a step in that direction. Anyone who's admining 0365, they're getting forced onto 2FA. So good one, Microsoft.
Yeah, no, that's it's a good choice. What they've done here is make multi-factor auth the default for administrators. It's not obviously with end users; they charge you to have multi-factor auth, jerks. But at least
do they still do that? Because someone told me that, and I looked around and I couldn't find it.
I'm not 100% sure if that's still the current case. It was the last I looked, which is a little while ago now, maybe a year. Last I went,
yeah. Someone let us know if Microsoft is still charging for 2FA for basic 2FA for 0365, because they should not be.
Yeah, certainly for the corporate, the enterprise accounts. Like if you've got personal ones, then I think it's a different story. But last I looked, with the enterprise ones, you had to have like a certain subscription tier, and that was essentially double the monthly per user cost to get multi-factor auth. But yeah, maybe it's changed. Hopefully it has. Either way, they've added it as the default for administrators, which is, you know, good for administrators and bad for everybody who wants to break in like me. So, boo.
Now, after last week's feature, I got a really interesting email from Ryan Callumber over at Proofpoint, who was saying, you know, okay, 2FA would be a great step in the right direction. But he also pointed out that there are some serious deficiencies when it comes to Exchange web services that attackers are exploiting, right? Like brooting some of the non-2FA-able applications. So there's a ways to go. It seems like Microsoft, you know, they've done a successful transition to a cloud-based, you know, Office model and, you know, Exchange model. That's all great. But it does seem like they're lagging on the authentication side pretty heavily, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and I mean, certainly they have a bunch of complicated products that they do have to kind of retrofit from being on-prem, you know, run by a team of admins for small user groups relative to the cloud business to, you know, run by Microsoft in the cloud with all this kind of different threat model and different attacks. And yeah, it is a difficult transition for them. And yeah, attackers absolutely don't know which of the various endpoints off the end of Outlook Web Access and stuff don't require 2FA. So yeah, please don't fix all of those. We can't like them.
Yeah, but so do people who are stealing the entire life savings for, you know.
Well, yes, of course.
I mean, it's just...
You should fix them. Yes, I'll put my responsible hat back on.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you. Oh, there was another wild ride of claim and counterclaim this week, Adam, when it comes to Apple and a supposed, pin cracking vulnerability.
Yeah, there's been obviously a lot of interest in tools for doing pin brute force against phones when you've got iPhones, when you've got physical access. We've talked about, you know, the gray key devices a bunch over the last couple of months. But anyway, when in the most recent version of iOS, there was a suggestion made by someone on Twitter, I think Hacker Fantastic on Twitter, saying that the brute force prevention wasn't working in the latest build of iOS, and that kind of turned into a bit of a tweet storm. When it turned out, in fact, that actually wasn't the case. The most recent releases or most recent betas, I think, have a feature where they'll look like they're processing PIN entry attempts, but actually not send them down into the secure enclave for processing. Apple says that this is because, you know, it's kind of stopping people butt dialing their PINs and locking their phones out or something. But yeah, maybe it's a useful security thing as well. Anyway, turned out they weren't actually, the brute force prevention controls were working, and, you know, the tweeters had a bit of a ride.
Yeah, well, a few media outlets actually covered it. And I know one journalist who was absolutely mortified because he'd posted on it was Zach Whitaker over at ZDNet, who's just, you know, he was more mortified than he needed to be, actually. And the story was that if you sent the pins sequentially with no spaces, it would keep processing them. So you just send a constant stream of numbers and that would work. But yeah, as you point out, that's not the case. I mean, this might have not have gotten this far if maybe Apple PR picked up the phone occasionally. I'm just putting that out there. Got an interesting story here, staying with iPhones. Joe Cox over at Motherboard is pointing out that police are going to be more likely to use sort of exigent circumstance excuses to rapidly unlock phones since Apple has introduced this one-hour lockout feature in the latest build of iOS. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the suggestion is that, you know, police have the powers to kind of act without a warrant differently, or, you know, have more powers to act without a warrant when there are, you know, circumstances that are changing very rapidly, where there's risk to life, where there's, in this case, you know, data that will become inaccessible if they don't access it very quickly, and that Apple, by introducing, you know, this feature that will, you know, stop PIN entry through the Lightning port, for example, you know, after a short period of time, constitutes this kind of, you know, exigent circumstance that would allow them to, you know, break into the phone, image it, so that they can then later get a warrant to process the data, which is, you can kind of see where they're going with it. I mean, and I think the conversation that kind of led to this article was based on an earlier release where the time was a week rather than an hour. And that obviously kind of changes the dynamic a bit. I mean, having to do it in an hour does, you know, is perhaps, you know, a much more pressing circumstance than a week.
Well, but we have seen approaches like this from law enforcement before. I mean, Australia passed laws some years ago allowing for data preservation orders to be sent from police to certain providers saying you need to keep this data while we get a warrant. So it sort of seems like maybe that will be the way that this winds up happening.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you could imagine that. I mean, maybe there'd be, you know, in the distant future where we've sorted out all these problems, there'll be some kind of process for just kind of freezing the device in time and then accessing it later. I guess almost in the style of Ray Ozzie's suggestion, you know, that we kind of, I guess we shot down a month or two ago, whenever that was. But yeah, I mean, I guess you can kind of see, you know, some combination of that, you know, that legal process and then technical controls to make it happen.
Firefox is partnering with Have I Been Pwned in what looks to be a really useful, you know, in creating a really useful feature.
Yeah, I think this is a tie-in so that when you go to log into a web service or you store passwords using the Firefox Password Manager or something, it will tell you if they've been nicked, which, yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of useful. I mean, obviously, it's dependent on the quality of data that's in Have I Been Pwned, which, you know, I guess the question is how long can Have I Been Pwned be comprehensive? I don't know. That's a good question. But yeah, I'm certainly useful. If your password is in there, then that's, you know, useful information for everybody.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've got a lot of passwords.
I mean, they do have a lot of passwords.
And they'll tell you when one's weak. I mean, all they're going to tell you is if one actually exists in their database, not, you know, what account it's linked to or whatever, right? So it's just like you're using a password that we have a hash of. You know, I think that's actually quite a good thing, because I really am impressed with what Troy's been able to do with Have I Been Pwned, which is taking this sort of weird awareness-raising website and actually turn it into something useful, because he's come up with some uses for it that I certainly didn't predict myself. VirusTotal is launching a monitoring tool for software developers so that they can help to prevent false positives among AV companies. This is interesting.
Yeah, this seems like a pretty, you know, sensible sort of thing. Like if you're a software developer and you release a new update and it gets flagged by some, you know, obscure one of the, you know, like 70 or whatever antivirus products that VirusTotal aggregates, then it's going to ruin your day. It's going to ruin your rollout. Maybe you're rolling out a security update and it ruins that too. So, I mean, there's plenty of reasons why software developers would be keen to in advance know about that and not, I mean, having to run up every one of those AVs yourself in your QA process. All right, that's a pain. And yeah, VirusTotal having a way to do that that doesn't involve, you know, publishing your pre-release software to VirusTotal, probably is a thing they would welcome. So yeah, it seems like a good idea.
Yep. WPA3 is on its way. The standard has been released.
Yeah, there's been a lot of media coverage in the, you know, kind of tech press about the WPA3 standard being released. There's a bunch of interesting security features, and certainly security is one of the key kind of things that they are tweaking between the older releases of the wireless spec and WPA3. It's a bit early to really say how effective that's going to be. Obviously, anytime they change the standard, we find new and interesting ways to break it, and that kind of particular standards making process has a history of kind of cocking it up, frankly.
You know,
going back to WEP, and there's been a few bits in WPA that were also a bit shaky. They're introducing a couple of new modes. There's a new kind of replacement for the pre-shared key mode that actually does a bunch of improvements. I mean, one of the things they're trying to kill is offline brute force attacks against the password. So that remains to be seen how effective that is, but certainly it looks good on paper. And then, yeah, there's a bunch of other changes as well to the more enterprise modes. I haven't read a lot of good technical information about the particular bits of it that, in my opinion, they should address yet. That's obviously going to shake out, once we start seeing implementations of the enterprise auth systems and auth modes and the clients and stuff. So, yeah, that's going to be one that I think we'll see a few stories about over the next couple of years.
Palo Alto Networks has turned up an interesting malware sample, which looks a little bit Stuxnet-y in that it's, very much spreading via a USB vector.
Yeah, so this report is about a campaign in South Korea that's using USB, as I read it so far, is reading USB drives to move like command and control messages and data back between, some implant that's already across an air gap. And there isn't any suggestion in the reporting so far of how that initial kind of infection across the air gap occurred. So in Stuxnet, obviously, we had some USB auto run style bugs. In this case, we don't know what that is, but there is evidence that the USB devices are being targeted to cross the air gaps for command and control. And the interesting tie-in is that they are specifically targeting USB devices based on their vendor and product ID that come from a particular manufacturer in South Korea that's in the defense industry. I think that's kind of how it looked. So, I guess we don't have enough context about exactly what the devices are and how they're used to really say, but certainly it's an interesting campaign. Also, it looks like they're targeting specifically XP and 2003 systems, or the code is tuned for those environments. So, that's one of the things that air gaps have against them, right? Is that people say, oh, well, we've got an air gap, therefore
so we can
don't
run
have
any
about.
Old piece of crap. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, attackers know that. They do.
Yep. So my intro to this next piece is going to be sort of signs of the timesy, which is a South Korean cryptocurrency exchange got owned and lost $30 million. Boring.
I know, right? Boring. And so boring that they're like, we're just going to cover the losses.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Isn't it crazy? They're like a $30 million cryptocurrency like theft these days. I mean, it's on CyberScoop. Didn't see it anywhere else.
Yeah, exactly. Because no one cares.
Can you imagine 5 years ago? That's like front page news. Holy crap. Look at this. Wow. Cryptocurrency is getting stolen. Now it's just like, yeah, okay.
Although, funny, this is the same exchange that got owned by North Koreans to the tune of, I think it was only $7 million last time, which is last year, same exchange. So, yeah.
Got a bug in WordPress core doing the rounds. Is it a big deal?
It's It's an interesting – this particular bug is – well, you decide. You decide whether it's big or not, I'll tell you. So as I gather, the deal is if you can post blog post to a blog and you can attach images, then you can also delete images. So you upload a thing, attach the blog post, change your mind, delete it. You can path traverse the delete and arbitrarily delete a file on the blog. Now, that might not seem super useful, but if you delete the configuration, then the system goes back into setup mode. You hit the /setup URL, then you can reconfigure it and get access to the underlying system, get access to the existing database, reconfigure it so that it now works again, except now that you're administrator. So kind of big deal.
Kind of. It's like Privesque for people who've already got post rights.
Well, yeah. So, in some cases, I can see that being really terrible. And in other cases, it's meh. If you can post, then you probably can already.
The reason we're mostly interested in things like Drupal and WordPress bugs is from an internet health point of view, because, that Drupalgeddon thing was pretty serious.
Yeah. Obviously, a bug in WordPress core that, let you just pre-auth own every WordPress on the internet would be a really big deal. So, yeah, anything that touches WordPress core does have the potential to go pretty big.
Oh, we got an interesting post here from a guy called Jake Archibald, who calls himself a developer advocate for Google Chrome, which is, not so much a security researcher title, but it looks like he's found a pretty sweet set of browser bugs.
Yeah, now this his blog has a really good write-up of the process by which he stumbled across and then kind of turned into interesting and reporting this particular bug, which is a cross-origin request bug where you can convince a browser to make a request to another website, and normally in that circumstance you're not really able to read the response, because if you could, that would be really bad. It would break same origin policy. Anyway, this bug lets you, using a service worker, basically make a range request for an HTTP resource and then have the browser redirect to another place and get it, and then feed it back into, in this case, the audio API, and then on Edge in particular, you're then able to retrieve the resulting audio data, and by crafting that just right, you can end up like parsing the content of the results of the HTTP request out of the audio stream and thus recover the contents of the data. So, I mean, pretty much the net result is use ads, browse to malicious site, you've got, you know, Gmail open in another tab, it makes a request to Gmail and reads your mail. And then they suck it out through the audio, which is pretty cool.
I know, it's pretty cool, right? Like, I just remember, because I just remember going through the through this post and just going, okay, where's he going with this? Where's he going with this? And then it's like, damn.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty cool bug. And as you say, like the process by which he kind of stumbled across it is kind of fun and interesting as well. And he talks through also the process of reporting that the particular one where you can read the contents and the one that was a slightly less severe variant in Firefox. And he compares and contrasts the process of reporting a bug to Firefox, where it was like fixed in a couple of hours by the dev, and the process of reporting it to Microsoft, which did not go particularly well for him. And yeah, Microsoft, I think they figured out what they did wrong there, but yeah, it did not make for a good read.
Project Zero have just dropped a white paper, which looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, this is a white paper describing some of the research they've been doing using an instrumented box emulator, so x86 emulator, to run, you know, Windows and Linux and look for initialized memory leaks, so where the kernel returns memory to user space that's got contents in it for some reason. Anyway, they've come up with a bunch of tools for kind of programmatically finding that sort of bug, and they've been talking about it at a few cons, Recon, Montreal, and Infiltrate and stuff. So yeah, white paper's out. It's a... as usual for Google, Project Zero is pretty heavy going. But yeah,
if you're into that sort of thing. It's not exactly light reading, is it?
No, it's not. But I mean, that's what we expect from that lot. So, you know,
yeah, that's stuff. Right. That's right. And Adam, our skateboarding dog this week is some defense/surveillance company is shopping around a surveillance van that costs $5 million and claims to do like long range Wi-Fi interception and comes complete with ODA and stuff. It's just ridiculous.
It is. It's great marketing. And that's what's so good about this. I mean, it's the, you know, the classic, you know, cyber pew pew map sells SIEM systems. Like, this is the, if we have a sweet van with like cool, that's painted black with cool blue lighting, then no one will care about the fact that actually it's just a Raspberry Pi with a couple of high power, you know, Wi-Fi cards bodged into it and some ODA we bought off somebody else. Like, you put it in a sweet van, then people are going to like, this is what movie hacking looks like. I've seen sneakers. They had a van. I want a van too for my police force, even though it costs $5 million. Where's my checkbook, sir? You know, and that's kind of what they're aiming for here. They do claim to have some actual, you know, ODA that can own devices over the wireless for various different operating systems. But, I mean, you know, who knows?
I mean do you spend $5 million on the van and then someone squashes those bugs and then you're like, oh, okay. Well,
at least I got a sweet van.
At least I got a nice van, you know, maybe rip out the monitors, put in a bed, go camping. Sounds pretty good.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's future-proofing your investment in ODA right there. I'd buy a van.
What other ODA can you buy where when it gets squashed, you can use it to go and
you can
travel
drive
to wonderful places?
You can ride around in your ODA. Whose bugs can you ride around
in? Right. That's right. That's right. Okay, we got to stop this madness. Adam, thank you very much for joining us this week, mate. It's a pleasure as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. We'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Now, before we move on to this week's sponsor interview, just a quick rerun of last week's announcement. DCSO, the German cybersecurity organization, they are hiring multiple positions. The jobs are in Berlin, and they are to research, analyze, and produce intelligence for its German multinational clients. They've got positions for malware analysts, back-end developers, regional threat intelligence experts. DCSO is a little bit different. It's a private company founded by a group of German multinationals, and it was founded in order to maximize security resources and to support research, and it prioritizes efficacy over immediate profits. Successful candidates will have an understanding of major actors and issues, strong analytical skills, and language skills and regional knowledge are an advantage. Further information is available at dcso.de, and interested parties should contact them at careers@dcso.de. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Marco Slaviero of Thinkst Canary. Thinkst is a smaller vendor, but also the biggest single sponsor of Risky Business Weekly episodes. So I'm guessing by now you all know who they are. They're the ones who make the little hardware honeypots. And, you know, a lot of people wonder why Thinkst packaged them in the way they did. They're in a little, you know, tiny little device. They look like a portable hard drive. And the reason is actually pretty simple. They're packaged like that so people who buy them don't need to beg for rack space. The whole idea is the security group can just grab a few and just plug them in wherever they find, an Ethernet port. The key is simplicity. Now, of course, Thinkst also makes virtual canaries and does some great stuff on the console side with canary tokens, but it always comes back to that key thing, which is to make it easy. Now, some people would say a company like Thinkst is in the so-called deception business. Now, I'm becoming more accepting of the term, but it is still a pretty cringy way to describe what they do. But what's even more cringy is some of the thinking behind the more elaborate deception technologies. There are vendors out there that sell these bells and whistles deception platforms that automatically spin up fake environments and stuff, and, you know, they cost a fortune, they're difficult to deploy, and it's all just a bit herpa-derpa. Marco Slaviero joined me to talk about dumb approaches to deception, and here's what he had to say.
The one thing that we've seen some of the other folks do is that they'll try and embed fakery or deceptive documents inside of the workflow where users would normally see them. So one example would be the recent documents feature. And once you're putting documents inside of a user's actual recent documents, like, they're either going to click them by mistake, or they're going to start ignoring recent documents, which takes away a whole useful feature of their environment.
So what, they're putting like fake stuff into regular, you know, user workflow.
Exactly. And at that point, you're just increasing the chances of your false positives. And you're also decreasing the user's ability to get stuff done.
But that just seems like a really weird thing to do. Like, I got to be honest, like, if you're, you know, okay, your workstation gets popped and you're worried that they're going to go to the most recently viewed documents, aren't they just going to like basically pillage the box? Like, are they really going to be that careful?
So you're gonna find all sorts of attackers, but like, this would be one example of folks sitting at a whiteboard going, how do we think an attacker might best discover a document? And it's just the sort of thing that, as I said, like, it sounds kind of plausible, but actually at the end of the day, it's unlikely to be very effective.
It sounds cool, but it's going to result in mostly false positives that get people excited.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which in truth is a lot of this stuff. So the smashing of deception together with machine learning is another one of those trends that, for us, it sort of sounds good on a whiteboard, but when it actually comes to implementation, there's a lot more variables. And our take on this stuff is usually simple beats complex almost every time.
Look, absolutely right. I think, as I say, I think people are getting a little bit too clever for their own good with this stuff. And, you know, there's this whole thing like automation and orchestration are becoming big trends in InfoSec, but you don't really want a dynamic deception environment. You know, it just doesn't make sense in so many levels. That's why I like the simple stuff. I like what Rapid7 does with service accounts, because they've got a UEBA product and they put in a few fake service accounts that just look way too tempting when you've dumped them. And that's a really high quality signal. And I love what Canary does. Because again, high quality signaling, and in your case, certainly, I mean, it's barely even qualifies as a project to deploy it. It's just very easy.
So the Rapid7 stuff, I can well see being effective. So as you say, it's going to be, they're going to effectively expose those fake credentials to attackers. And it's only attackers who are going to be finding them. But if you take that as an example, again, they're not in a regular user's workflow. Regular users aren't going out there dumping creds. So that sort of approach does make sense.
But is this something you're seeing as an actual trend, or is this just one idiot vendor that did this?
If we look at the last couple of years, so we're now sort of 2.5 years into, I guess, the cycle of some kind. And this year at RSA, deception didn't seem to be as buzzwordy. And we are a vendor who kind of plays in that space, although we don't really use that term. So without the deception buzzword this year at RSA, there also seems to be some of the vendors in the space are migrating, or at least pivoting towards other kinds of products away from pure deception ones. We've also seen relatively notable folks in the industry moving away from these companies. So in terms of buzzwordy, I think deception may be was sort of hitting a bit of that trough of disillusionment for some of the folks.
So you're thinking that's where we are in the hype cycle. The mania has died down, and the hangover is taking hold.
at least some disillusionment in terms of, as you say, like these overly complex overly complex approaches, which sort of require the kitchen sink. So I think there is a little bit of that that's going on. And yeah, so the vendors who overpromise what they do, I think basically some of that comes back to bite them. You know, if they're trying to pitch large deals and hundreds of thousands of dollars, basically that becomes quite a big project. So we were sitting with a customer this week, and for these guys, running any sort of IT project is a massive pain. So basically, they're a really large financial, and Canary gives them the ability to do it with a small team rather than having to involve all sorts of aspects of their organization.
Well, see, this is the thing, right? I can't imagine you would ever roll something like Rapid7's IDR stuff just so you could trigger on fake accounts, right? Like, that's just one little thing that they've baked into an existing product because it makes sense there. And right. I just can't, it just doesn't make sense to me that there are these entire deception companies that do all of this fancy orchestration and whatever, and you sort of have to. I mean, you're right. It's a project, right? It shouldn't be. This stuff shouldn't be a project. It's more of an approach than a product class. I mean, Canary's a little bit different. It's designed to be simple. It's not designed to be this. It's not designed to be a project.
It is a vendor pitchy kind of thing. But look, we are, we do try to keep this stuff as simple and trivial to manage as possible while keeping it high value.
What do you think of this idea, though, that, you know, deception might be more of a way of thinking that vendors can, infuse their products with rather than being, you know, like that there's going to be deception vendors and stuff?
So, like, it's something that when we were still doing pen testing and doing AppSec evaluations, it's something that we used to mention to our customers, but also in that kind of consultant way where you can tell them to do something without a lot of thought about how they actually were going to do it. The idea that you could embed inside an application detections for badness seems like a good idea. So at some point, OWASP had a Java library for detecting bad stuff inside of Java applications. That thing seemed to be a reasonable idea at the time. I don't know that it went particularly far, but I can see that vendors would increasingly want to build in a deception into their applications.
So again, I mean, in that case, it's sort of like obfuscation. Well, it's not obfuscation. What is it? It's like tamper alerting, or, you know, when someone starts fuzzing something or hitting weird variables that they shouldn't be hitting. I mean, it makes sense to do it in applications as well, right? You know, you just define the areas, you create some areas where there's no legitimate reason for a user to enter those areas. And then if something enters them, you kind of know something's up. And that applies to networks, applications, whatever.
So I'm mostly in agreement. I think the thing there to be careful is just that, just like within other deception players, it's easy to get caught up in a spy versus spy game. So I seem to recall at least one customer who had this idea to divert. So they were an internet banking customer, and they had a plan to basically divert attackers to like a fake internet banking site once they detected that the attackers had used credentials that they'd seeded on phishing sites.
But I thought we decided this bait and switch stuff was a terrible idea in like 2003.
Yeah. So that sort of deception stuff, as I said, is like, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think you're going to be playing lots of spy versus spy games at that point.
This whole concept where you see marketed about trapping attackers, you know what I mean, and sending them off into fake environments, that just seems a bit daft.
Yeah. So that bit I'm not in favor of for sure.
Marco, this is a promotional interview. So why don't you tell us what's new with you over there at Canary?
So the major thing that we've got coming up, and this basically has come out of customers who've got a ton of birds spread across different time zones, different teams. What they have been looking for is the ability to basically segment them and manage them as groups. With customers with the larger teams, it becomes effectively, if you've got a ton of birds and you've got an office out there in Australia, and you've got an admin there who should be getting the alerts for them and wants to manage them, following, as I said, our bird theme, you now get a flock that you can assign birds to. So this is upcoming. It's not yet released, but this is the major thing that we are currently working on. So with your flock, you'd be able to configure like a per flock whitelist or a notification options or assign administrators.
As opposed to having separate accounts for each, you know, grouping. So it's all under the one account there. And I'd imagine someone right at the top can, the big boss can then delegate.
Of course. But yeah, that's the major thing.
All right, Marco Slaviero, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to talk about where the so-called deception industry is at. I think we can say a fair bit of Silicon Valley investor cash has been burned in deception, but maybe the approach itself isn't that rubbish. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
That was Marco Slaviero there from Thinkst Canary. You can check Canary out at canary.tools. Big thanks to them for that and for being our number one weekly show sponsor last year and this year. We love their work. I will be back soon with more Risky Business, but until then, from Jungle Out There Studios, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
My name is Clyde Minisco. I'm into light without a toe. I'm the color of your palette. The canvas on your easel. I'm slamming.